oven, repeated and untraceable. And while frozen corn is still mostly frozen corn, no matter the brand, Fox News tastes a little different than NPR and seldom has the same ingredients, ultra-processed versus semi-organic. Maybe March will turn around and be February again. Maybe 2024 will be suspended, at least delayed. If 2023 happens all over again, who'll notice? We're still getting Trump's legal stalls, the coming election, wars in Ukraine and Gaza, the hottest year ever again. The news is streaming. You can tune in anytime and neither miss or learn a thing. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dad Raphael, Reed Johnson, David Rothenberg, and Birdie. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Nadia Ramlagan, Suzanne Potter, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Zoe Carina.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go on to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth and have a good night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, about his latest article. It's called Advocates Urge Multnomah County to Act on Noxious Gas Pollution. A coalition of public health experts and environmental organizations want the county to phase out gas appliances. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So listeners might remember when this U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission report came out last year about the negative health impacts of having a gas stove in the home. That was on the national level, but just recently there was a local report on the same topic. So what did that find? What is the impact in Oregon?
Yeah, that report was by the Sierra Club, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, Verde, RMI, Beyond Toxic. They released this report saying that the use of fossil fuel in homes and in buildings is like greatly contributes to asthma and other respiratory illnesses thanks to the NOx emissions. It also, just to sort of illustrate that, showed that fossil fuel equipment in Oregon homes and businesses released more than 4,000 tons of NOx emissions each year, which is an equal environmental contribution of pollution equal to 1.1 million passenger cars.
Well, when this national level report came out, there was all this talk of governmental bodies regulating gas stoves, there was a surprising amount of backlash connecting, you know, owning and using a gas stove to individual choice and freedom. But it's not just people in the home that are impacted. Is that right?
Right. I guess kind of as ever, you know, environmental and health advocates are well aware that flat out banning gas stoves and then coming in and taking them from people's apartments might constitute a bit of a government overreach and probably is not a great way to approach a just transition to cleaner sources of energy. But that's kind of not the point, despite the backlash. The point is for these to be more as these appliances become obsolete, then they would be phased out, and there are cleaner sources of energy. The science is there, the appliances are there, they're just very costly right now. But there would be a way to sort of phase those into homes and buildings at that point.
Well, you interviewed Damon Mott's story from the Sierra Club about this. And one thing that I noticed that they highlighted was that it's also that these fumes get vented to the outside. It's not just that they stay in your kitchen forever, which I thought was an interesting component.
Right. Yeah, I thought that was interesting too, and I think that's a bit of a change in the way that they are approaching these things, not so much from an individual point of view, but like, what they said was what's in somebody's kitchen is their own business, so to speak, but what gets vented into the outdoors becomes everybody's business. And that's kind of the new thing. We all can, you know, probably look outside our apartments or walk around a neighborhood and see, NOx gas emissions from people's heating elements and appliances just going directly out in the atmosphere, and that actually causes impacts to public health.
So off of this report, local organizations have asked Multnomah County for action. What did their letter say?
Yeah, the coalition is urging Multnomah County in its role as the local health authority, first to kind of increase public awareness of the dangers of burning gas in homes and buildings. That's kind of the individual aspect of it. But some of the greatest emissions and the subsequent health risks come from large commercial buildings, many of which rent space to other tenants. And the landlords and owners of those buildings don't really have much of an incentive to upgrade to safer energy systems. So the letter ask the county to leverage federal funding to enable low-income residents and people of color to transition to electric appliances and pursue some binding emission standards for new appliance sales and to help, develop regulations around that.
What are some of the things that the county has the power to do in this situation versus not, I guess?
The county has already halted new gas infrastructure within county buildings. These are more, they have the power to incentivize local businesses and, builders who are building four times in one sentence, but, sort of a carrot and the stick thing to encourage people. I think of new windows, the Oregon Eco Trust or whatever had these new windows. And so all of a sudden, most apartment buildings in the city and the county and the state have newer windows than when the home was initially built. So there's some sort of incentivizing things like that. This coalition of advocates want to at least get started on that. They said they've been asking for this for a long time, and there should at the very minimum be an office who can start to develop these kinds of programs and ways of transitioning to more just systems of infrastructure.
Off of this letter, what has been the reaction at the county?
Sort of has been non-committal so far. Jessica Vega Peterson, listed off a couple of successes. The county has been, to a certain extent, as a public health authority, has been responsible for some really positive things when it comes to addressing climate change and environmental impacts. A few things that people argue are performative. And so there's, like I said, the prohibiting fossil fuel infrastructure in the county are positive things that Vega Peterson and this board has done already. Vega Peterson said, one thing is clear, more action on the climate crisis is needed at all levels of government. Whether or not there is a direct outcome, that we can expect now is, still an open question.
Has this sort of change been made elsewhere?
Actually, just recently, it was on March 15th, environmental and health advocates in California at the Bay Area Air Quality Management District won the first in the country, zero NOx emission standard for furnaces and water heaters. That's an effort to phase out new gas furnaces over the next decade as older appliances become obsolete. So these are the kinds of things that can sort of copy and paste legislation a little bit and start to have a much broader impact. Berkeley has been at the forefront, actually, of this kind of regulation for a long time with, trying to pass things to not build new infrastructure with methane gas.
Well, like we touched on earlier, you spoke with Damon Mott Story of Sierra Club for this piece, and they pointed out that there's an equity component of this as well with the nitrous oxide. Can you describe some of those disparate impacts?
Yeah, Multnomah County report actually in November of 2022 said that low-income people and people of color are 1.5 times more likely to live in an area with poor air quality compared to white people. And the CDC reports that asthma rates have been much higher among black children. So that is on the minds of the coalition that's working to phase out gas appliances because economic and racial justice are central tenets for any plans to address environmental damages done by fossil fuels. And that's a big reason that they say that Multnomah County needs to start planning for that future right now, because the not all neighborhoods provide equitable outcomes.
In your piece, you also made mention of this lawsuit filed by the county against big oil companies for their role in causing climate change, and specifically the 2021 heat dome. Can you describe that in more detail? I know it's a little bit of a pivot.
Yeah, it's a bit of a pivot, but it's definitely related, because if you think about the funding that might come from a pretty massive lawsuit, that is, if people ask where's the money going to come from to replace all of these old appliances, this would be one of those things. Last year, Multnomah County unanimously voted to sue big oil companies for their role in causing climate change, and it was specifically based around the heat dome. It seeks $50 million in actual damages, $1.5 billion in future damages, and $50 billion to better prepare for the impacts of climate change. These are the sort of resiliency projects that we've seen already. There are air conditioning units that are going into low-income neighborhoods that can actually help people to survive the impacts of climate change. And things like this are also what advocates are calling for now.
What do you hope that readers and listeners take away from this story?
The advocates that I talked to, Damon Mott's story, at the Sierra Club, is encouraging people to call the county, to encourage them to at least start to look into this. They're hoping that something can be done and voted on by Earth Day, which is coming up in about a month. NOx gas emissions are bad inside the home. It's worth always reminding people and reminding myself that if you're cooking with a gas stove, you're encouraged to open a window or a door because the health impacts are very negative. But this is what a just transition, to cleaner sources of energy looks like.
Where can folks find a copy of your piece for themselves?
The best way to get Street Roots is to find a vendor in your neighborhood. They accept cash, Venmo, and tips. You can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
It's worth mentioning that reporting can get results on a not so far off sort of related issue. The Portland City Auditor this week found that Zenith Energy violated city lobbying code. That's something that Street Roots had reported just last summer, and it's interesting to see that after their investigation, they found that Zenith did in fact violate lobbying code.
Well, thank you for highlighting that, and thank you for talking with us today, Jeremiah. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest article. It's called Advocates Urge Multnomah County to Act on Noxious Gas Pollution. A coalition of public health experts and environmental organizations want the county to phase out gas appliances. More information on that article is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. What accounts for Russia's very strong reaction to any kind of activity near its borders that leaders might see as even a possible threat? University of Montana history professor Richard Drake has been looking into that question. He recently wrote an article for Counterpunch about the 1971 testimony of four American historians, Adam Ullman, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., William Appleman Williams, and D.F. Fleming, before a House subcommittee that wanted to hear their views about the origins of the Cold War and what course it might take as the Vietnam War raged on. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Drake about the testimony of these historians and how it relates to U.S. foreign policy today.
When I was reading your article, you were focusing on what's happened in the 20th century. Is there something in the Russian habit of mind that goes back? Is it somehow ingrained deep in people who grow up there that they can be invaded at any time?
It dealt with some of the reasons why Russia is unusually sensitive to the prospect of foreign troops massing on its borders. The article really took root from research I'd been doing on a book about William Appleman Williams, a revisionist historian of the Cold War. I discovered that Williams and three other historians gathered in the House of Representatives subcommittee meeting in 1971 to hear what the leading historians in the country had to say about the war in Vietnam, which in 1971 was still raging, and what likely future developments would take place in the Cold War as a result of the war in Vietnam. Now, the other historians who were there to testify were Arthur Meyer Schlesinger Jr., Kennedy advisor and consultant, liberal Democrat.
Part of the Brain Trust, yeah.
Yeah, part of the Brain Trust. Adam Ulam, who was a Russian historian, a very conservative, very supportive of American foreign policy in the Cold War, Harvard professor, and D.F. Fleming, a Vanderbilt historian, left of center of the political spectrum in interpreting the Vietnam War and the Cold War. He explained to them, the Russians have had a uniquely disastrous experience. As I listened to what Fleming had to say, I kept thinking about the war in Ukraine in our own day and why the Russians might have been unusually concerned about the possibility of yet another invasion, adding to the collection of invasions that they've experienced. Fleming gave a marvelous overview of the catastrophes that befell Russia, beginning in 1915 when the Germans invaded in the First World War, and then with the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, the capitalist states invaded Russia trying to squelch the Bolshevik Revolution. They hated and feared Bolshevism. They knew what that meant. That meant a condemnation of capitalism. So this was uppermost in their minds to annihilate the possibility of that threat spilling beyond Russia's borders. The Nazi invasion, 1941 to 1945, the catastrophic consequences of that invasion, some 15 Russian cities were completely destroyed, possibly thousands of villages destroyed, some 27 million Russians died in that war. And so Fleming tried to explain that if you want to understand Russian attitudes toward the West in 1971, you need to be aware of this backstory. And unfortunately, our leaders and our people are not aware of it. They have a very shaky understanding of what happened in Russia. And reading that testimony, I thought this insight is maybe even more pertinent for 2024 than it was in 1971 for explaining Putin's reaction to the prospect of Ukraine joining NATO and having NATO's nuclear weapons on his own border.
And we also sometimes hear that when it comes to Ukraine in particular, Russian leaders view it as part of the heart of Russia. That is like ripping out their heart in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a large Russian population in eastern Ukraine. And as a result of that fact and the mistreatment that they endured following the Maidan Revolution of 2014, from that point on, the Russians in the eastern part of Ukraine felt victimized by developments for which the government of Ukraine was responsible. I think all those factors combined to create a situation in Putin's mind, remaining aware of this historical backdrop, a situation that he thought was an existential threat. toward Russia.
So the invasions that took place before the First World War and the Bolshevik Revolution, you would say are not as relevant?
No, I would say they're very relevant. In fact, I'm glad you raised that point because I added a section to that article concerning the work of Arnold Toynbee, British historian. He wrote a short book in 1953 called The World and the West. And his book is sort of an addendum to the argument that D.F. Fleming made in 1971. What Toynbee, with his wide-ranging understanding of history, he says, if you look at what has befallen Russia, not just considering the 20th century, Toynbee says, you really have to go back to the 13th century, because then Western invasions became a fact of life for the Russian people. The invasion of the Poles in 1610, the invasion of the Swedes in 1709.
Not the Mongols.
Huh. Now, he doesn't address that one, but he said there were others that might have been listed, but the French in 1812, and of course the Germans twice, 1915 and 1941. So what Toynbee adds to this historical picture of Russian sensitivity to border security, it's the eternal concern because of what they've experienced for hundreds of years. Toynbee adds a very important dimension to this interpretation of Russian history, really as a series of crises and traumas stemming from repeated invasions coming from the West. The war in Ukraine has to be understood in the same historical context, and it is not in the United States. Our media,
it's simply a matter of the Russians violating the integrity of Ukraine.
That's exactly it. And it's an interpretation that totally ignores history. It's only concerned with the political objectives, I think, of the United States. And there's absolutely no attention that I'm able to observe on American media paid to the Russian experience with invasions from the West, their fear of this, and why they could not allow the situation in Ukraine to stand.
Yeah, I think it's more the sense that look what they did after World War II. They took over Eastern Europe. Isn't this a repeat of that?
That's another point I think that D.F. Fleming, this historian from Vanderbilt, that he emphasized. He said, look, you just have to understand, although what Joseph Stalin did in 1945, imposing Russia's hegemony over Eastern Europe, was wrong, it's understandable, especially after losing 27 million people.
They did do the bulk of the fighting in Europe.
They won the war. Far more instrumental in defeating Nazi Germany than either the United States or the UK was. And so we really have to look at what happened after World War II from the viewpoint of the Russians and try to understand why that issue of border security was paramount to them, having just gone through this horrendously vicious war with Nazi Germany. Of course, they were going to say, no, we want no possible threat of that kind to materialize again. And I think that's just a focal point of Russian thinking in their dealing with their own foreign affairs.
And I imagine that's why there was opposition in Moscow to the reunification of Germany that Gorbachev agreed to.
Very much so. And this is why Gorbachev wanted to have assurances that NATO was not going to be moving toward the Russian border. And of course, we gave those assurances and then betrayed them. And I think the performance of American foreign policy leaders on this Ukraine issue has been extremely shabby. We have a situation there resulting in hundreds of thousands of casualties and incredible destruction that should have been solved diplomatically before February 24, 2022. There had to be a much more imaginative effort made there. Instead, what we did was to follow the Wolfowitz doctrine, which was really just to completely militarize American foreign policy. There will be no peer competitor allowed to emerge. This was 1992 when Wolfowitz presented this dogma, which has become a core element in American foreign policy thinking, in order to understand why we insisted on pushing NATO to Russia's borders. You have to keep that Wolfowitz doctrine in mind. This whole idea of following the Cold War, well, now that we're on top, we're going to stay on top. Well, the world is changing. and we need to change with it and to understand what the best way is to maintain peace and stability in the world instead of promoting the exigencies of the American empire, which I think is the only thing uppermost in the minds of our leaders.
Yeah, it seems like it would take a much more enlightened leadership to break free of that.
But where is that leadership going to come from is the great question of the moment as this 2024 presidential campaign gets underway and we listen to what President Biden has to say, what Donald Trump has to say. It's just all talk about the American empire. In Gaza, in Ukraine, there's no real effort to promote peace. The only effort is to promote war. And this is a sickness that is going to result in a threat to the world. The leaders in charge are incompetent. They really have an inadequate appreciation for history. They are caught in the toils of American imperialism. And this is driving the world into a dreadful corner.
If we don't oppose them, we are, in a sense, giving in to tyranny.
Well, that's the argument, but it seems to me to be a very unconvincing argument.
Apparently not to a lot of people.
I understand that. I understand that. But I think they're wrong, and I think they have to be shown to be wrong. If the world is to escape this constant spiral of war, revolution, and terror, being victimized by a leadership class with no imagination whatsoever for peace, the war party is leading us off a cliff. The Global South has completely resisted the American policy of economic sanctions against Russia. It's reacted in an almost overwhelmingly negative way because they don't
trust. And it has opposed U.S. policy
absolutely.
In Gaza as well.
Even more there. The destruction in Gaza is the crime of our time. There's nothing more evil going on in the world than that. It's a frightening, horrible atrocity. And to hear our leaders defending that and trying to explain why we need to fund it and to arm the perpetrators of that assault on these defenseless people, these 2,000-pound bombs that we're supplying, this is Exhibit A for the case that the leaders we have are inadequate to the moment. Unfortunately, the resistance and the dismay and all the moral protests have not affected policy. I really link Ukraine and Gaza. In my mind, they're really two examples of the same problem. And it's a point that D.F. Fleming makes in his testimony in 1971. What's happened in the world, what's happened in American foreign policy since the end of World War II is that we really have been in the business of defending the Bretton Woods financial system that was erected in 1944 at that economic conference where the International Monetary Fund was created, the World Bank was created. And that economic system is what we've been promoting worldwide. We've promoted it in Vietnam. We're promoting it in Ukraine. We're promoting it in all of our foreign policy military undertakings are connected with that. Another great historian, Gabriel Kolko, tried to show how you begin to understand what's going on in the world when you realize that one thread unites all of our wars. It's promoting this corporate capitalist system that was refined, developed at the Bretton Woods Conference 1944, and making this the global entity. That's the essence, the foundation of the rules-based order that President Biden is always talking about. And the question is that the order we really need? Is that the one we should be sacrificing all these lives for? Or do we need to rethink our system? Billions of people living on less than $2 a day. You wonder why there's terrorism and revolution and war in the world? The whole system is wretchedly wrong. And by promoting it and expanding it, we've embarked on a crusade that is unworthy of us as a people. I think our leaders need to be replaced. I think the foreign policy team that we currently have in Washington, the best thing that could happen to them would be retirement.
In the Vietnam era, you know, there was so much protest that eventually it did get to Congress and they did cut off the funding.
This is true, but as those four historians I mentioned at the very outset of our discussion today, even though they were very different in their reaction to American foreign policy, they all agreed that the Vietnam War was a catastrophe. And it was Arthur Meyer Schlesinger who actually said the words I'm about to repeat. The war in Vietnam has been a horrible and expensive education. We must have no more Vietnams. Well, we've been having nothing but more Vietnams ever since. I get as excited as any American about presidential politics, but you know, you really have to get discouraged when you think about how little difference it makes in our foreign policy, whether a Democrat or a Republican gets in, because the foreign policies stay the same. They don't change. The heart of the matter, I think, is on the negative side. The course of empire in American history is our great crisis, and we need to confront it. We need to understand it. That's what the 1,000 military bases worldwide are for. They're there to protect the empire. And we have to ask ourselves, is this the right investment we should be making? Is the military-industrial complex the right defining institution for America, which it has become? My argument would be no. Our greatest historian said, no, the course of American empire will lead us to the same destination that every single empire in recorded history has arrived at, and that's defeat, destruction, and disappearance.
That was University of Montana professor Richard Drake speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about what the testimony of four American historians back in 1971 can tell us about U.S. foreign policy and Russia's reaction today. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us. Help me now, babe. Please. You gotta help me.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.org.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in